Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. On today's show, we'll feature a report and interview segment with Chicago organizer Michael Miranda, who is working on the future of the Internet in Illinois and the Illinois Telecommunications Act. We'll also include a summary of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes. But first, let's hear these news briefs courtesy of The New Standard. Three TV stations are fined for failing deaf people in a time of crisis. The Ford Motor Company faces a lawsuit over discriminatory lending practices. Concerns over tasers grow as taser-related deaths and injuries mount. And a wealthy businessman sets a record for tax evasion. After three local television stations in San Diego seemingly failed to provide emergency information about October 2003 wildfires in a visual format accessible to deaf and hard-of-hearing viewers, the Federal Communications Commission has proposed fines totaling $65,000. The commission says this is the first time it has leveled sanctions under a 2000 rule requiring TV stations to provide emergency information using closed captioning or other visual formats. The agency said it initiated an investigation after a community member complained that KUSI, KFMB, and KGTV were each broadcasting information about closures and evacuations due to wildfires without providing the crucial messages to the deaf and hard of hearing. After reviewing tapes of the station's broadcasts, the agency concluded that each station had, on several occasions, neglected to provide the same emergency information to its hearing-impaired viewers as it broadcast to its hearing audience. For their part, KUSI and KFMB, which are to be fined $25,000 and $20,000 respectively, have denied that they failed to provide the required information and format in a timely manner. KGTV's vice president, Derek Dalton, said the station, in addition to paying a fine of $20,000, is making improvements in meeting with representatives of the deaf and hard-of-hearing communities. The stations have 30 days to pay the fines or contest them. Tens of thousands of black customers who bought cars from the Ford Motor Company are accusing the car manufacturer's credit division of discrimination in its lending practices. The class action suit against Ford Motor Credit, which opened before a federal judge in Nashville, alleges that black customers were charged higher rates than white car buyers. The lawsuit marks the first time a case against an auto lender accused of discriminatory lending practices has gone to trial. The case concerns markups, a practice in which dealers charge an interest rate higher than the lender requests and either pocket the difference or split it with the lending institution. Consumer advocates have long sought to restrict and eventually eliminate the practice altogether. The lawsuit alleges that Ford Credit's Primus division discriminated against black car buyers by tacking additional percentage points onto the interest rates of their loans. Between 2001 and 2004, Primus charged 62% of its black customers a markup, compared to 41% of white customers. In addition, the markups Primus charged to blacks were significantly higher than those charged to whites, an average of $862 for blacks compared to $475 for whites, according to a study released in 2004 by Mark A. Cohen, an economist at Vanderbilt University. The financing divisions of other leading car manufacturers, including General Motors, Nissan, and Honda, have also been accused of discriminatory lending practices. All three companies settled the lawsuits before they went to trial. The death of a 54-year-old and the hospitalization of a 14-year-old after police stunned them with a controversial weapon in Chicago in February 2005 are the latest in a growing number of debatable uses of the potentially deadly tasers, which is sparking community outrage across the United States. The teenager went into cardiac arrest after police shocked him with the 50,000-volt weapon, and although he survived, another man died after police shocked him. The Illinois Department of Children and Family Services Guardianship Administrator, which serves as the teen's legal guardian, has filed lawsuits against both the police officer and the city of Chicago. The incidents come as the taser manufacturer's advertising and marketing techniques are under federal investigation. Since June 2001, more than 70 people have died in police custody in the United States and Canada after being struck with tasers, with the number of reported cases rising each year, according to a November 2004 report by the human rights group Amnesty International. In 5 of these cases, an autopsy found that the taser shock was the main cause of death. In several others, coroner's reports identified the taser as a likely contributing factor. The weapons critics also maintain that many deaths in which the taser has not been implicated could, in fact, be related to electrical shock from the device. Amnesty International commissioned a forensic pathologist to review some fatal cases in which tasers were used. In some cases, he found that, in addition to the official causes of death, which are often listed as heart failure, drug use, or head injuries, tasers may have contributed. The guns typically work by firing a pair of pronged darts that latch onto clothing or skin and send a 50,000-volt shock into the body in 5-second bursts, which overrides the subject's central nervous system, causing uncontrollable contraction of the muscle tissue and instant collapse. The darts are attached to wires which can reach up to 21 feet. People who have been tased report extreme debilitating pain. Taser International Incorporated now equips about 135,000 of the nation's 1 million police and corrections officers, according to Taser founder Thomas Smith. Over the past few years, more than 5,000 agencies in 49 states have bought tasers for approximately $1,000 each and given the stun devices to officers, often with minimal training. Taser International claims that its weapons are a safe alternative to conventional firearms and batons, but critics contend that the company has done very little to study the effects of tasers on humans of different ages and health backgrounds. A 1999 study funded by the Department of Justice on an electrical weapon similar to the taser found that it might cause cardiac arrest in people with heart conditions. Community activists in Miami are calling for a study of the effects of the weapons on children after the recent tasings of a 6-year-old boy who police say was holding a piece of glass and threatening to cut himself. In another incident in Florida, an officer chased down a 12-year-old girl who was skipping school and shocked her with a taser. In early 2005, police officers have tased high school students in schools in Madison, Wisconsin, and Prattville, Alabama. Officers in the St. Paul, Minnesota high schools will soon carry tasers, and in Jacksonville, Florida, over the objections of the Jacksonville Leadership Coalition, a citizens group, Duval County Sheriff's officers will soon be patrolling the local middle and high schools with weapons in their holsters. The Amnesty study found that Florida is the state in which officials have been most enthusiastic about tasers. There have been 17 deaths in Florida in taser-related incidents since 2000. The deaths, the use of the weapon on children, and the refusal by most police departments to reconsider their policies is fueling public opposition. In spite of the controversy, however, Taser International continues to find willing customers for its product. On February 14th, the El Paso, Texas Police Department and the Pima County, Arizona Sheriff's Department became the latest agencies to place orders for the weapons. The cracks in Taser International's refusal to allow the safety concerns surrounding its product may finally be starting to show. In January 2005, the Securities and Exchange Commission opened an informal inquiry into safety claims made by company officials. After the announcement, a group of Taser International's shareholders filed a class action lawsuit against the company, alleging that Taser issued a series of statements describing the safety of its products that were materially false and misleading. But the weapon is nowhere near disappearing from the streets, even if Taser International suffers from scandal. With Taser International's stock price fluctuating, gun manufacturer Smith & Wesson and several other companies have indicated that they are hoping to jump into the stun gun market. A United States telecommunication businessman accused of evading more than $200 million in taxes, the largest criminal tax case involving an individual, was arrested in March 2005 and charged with 12 counts of tax evasion. Walter Anderson, 51, created an offshore corporation to receive and conceal almost $500 million over 5 years, according to the indictment. The indictment also alleges Anderson claimed to be a resident of Florida, which has no state income tax, to avoid paying taxes in Washington, his actual place of residence. Anderson could face up to 80 years in prison if convicted. These reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard, on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Public airwaves that would otherwise have been used for new low-power FM community radio stations has instead been snapped up by speculators and is being sold off piecemeal to the highest bidder. The scandal began in 2003 when the FCC opened up an application window for FM translator stations. These are stations broadcasting with 250 watts of power or less that are limited by law to acting as repeaters for other broadcast outlets. Non-commercial broadcasters even feed translators via satellite. Several religious broadcast conglomerates have built national radio networks this way, utilizing hundreds of translator stations to do it. During the 2003 translator application window, more than 13,000 applications were filed. Had the FCC approved them all, it would have doubled the number of licensed radio stations in America overnight. Pete Treadish, founder of the Prometheus Radio Project, notes that of this application avalanche, two companies accounted for one-third of all the filings.
Radio Assist Ministry and Edgewater Broadcasting have applied for over 4,000 of the spots that would have been used for low-power radio stations in the United States.
But it gets even stranger. Radio Assist Ministries and Edgewater Broadcasting appear to be one and the same. They share a common mailing address in Twin Falls, Idaho. Since 2003, the FCC has issued more than 1,000 FM translator construction permits to Radio Assist and Edgewater combined. According to FCC records, Edgewater and Radio Assist have since disposed of 83 translator construction permits. Many of them were sold, netting a cool $803,000.
They generally sell them for about $6,000 for very rural areas. Medium areas, they sell them for $10,000, and slightly more populated areas, they go for $14,000 a piece.
Several of these permits were bought by incumbent religious broadcasters with large networks of translator stations already in place. In fact, the person behind the Edgewater / Radio Assist corporate entity is a former employee of Calvary Chapel of Twin Falls, Idaho. And Calvary Chapel bought 26 of Edgewater / Radio Assist's translator station construction permits, adding to the 350-plus translator station network it already has. Even more suspicious, those transactions were conducted via a shell corporation. Pete Treadish says it doesn't appear like any of this is illegal, but
I do think it's a perversion of the intent of the translator rules. It's a perversion of the job of the FCC to allow this sort of thing to go forward.
A pending rulemaking at the FCC and legislation on Capitol Hill both propose to expand the low-power community radio service, but the spectrum that's already been gobbled up by FM translator stations represents thousands of lost opportunities for true community radio.
As broadcast media makes the move from analog to digital, corporate content creators are looking to lock down their programming. Currently, it's no crime to tape a TV show or record songs off the radio. That practice, known as time shifting, has been upheld in the courts as proper employment of the fair use provision of U.S. copyright law. In the digital realm, however, plans are in the works to encode content data with what is called a broadcast flag. Such a flag embedded in the data would make it impossible for consumers to record anything. The FCC has already ruled that TV receiver and recording devices must recognize and comply with broadcast flag technology by July. But a court challenge led by the American Library Association questions the regulation's legality. Arguments were held in front of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals on February 22nd. Art Brodsky of the open access advocacy group Public Knowledge, another plaintiff in the case, says the initial reaction from the three-judge panel was quite skeptical to the idea that the FCC's authority extended as far as this.
It was not delegated by Congress to take control over consumer electronics and computing devices. The commission had never in its history taken such a step before.
The D.C. Circuit has not announced when it may rule on the case. Other freedom of information advocates are conducting workshops to help consumers buy or build their own broadcast flag-free technology before the July deadline arrives. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has even released a cookbook of sorts, providing step-by-step instructions for constructing an open-source, fair-use-compliant DTV receiver and recorder. Presumably, building such a system after the July deadline would run afoul of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which makes it a crime to use any technology designed to circumvent a copyright protection system.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature a report and interview segment with Chicago organizer Michael Miranda, who is working on the future of the Internet in Illinois and the Illinois Telecommunications Act. In recent years, the costs of establishing high-speed Internet networks has gone down, making it economically feasible for municipal communities to establish their own Internet networks. This has brought a struggle in state after state across America. On one side, communities and states strive to establish their own municipal internet and broadband networks, making them public services like water and electricity, to provide low cost and wide service, and based on the needs and desires and timetables of local communities. On the other side, major cable and telecommunications companies like SBC and Comcast are lobbying state by state to establish state-level bans on community internet rights in the hopes of gaining captured markets. As of February 2005, such bans on community internet deployments now hold in 14 states, with pending legislation to impose more bans in another 10 states, including Illinois. The Illinois General Assembly in 2005 will likely determine the digital future for the state of Illinois for years to come, with a 2005 rewrite of the main state law involving the internet, the Illinois Telecommunications Act. One community organizer who is working on municipal rights and on the Illinois Telecommunications Act is Michael Miranda, a Chicago resident who serves as president of the Association for Community Networking, the co-chair of the Illinois Community Technology Consortium, and president of the Chicago chapter of CTCNet, a nonprofit umbrella organization of community technology centers. I spoke with Michael Miranda and asked him to discuss more about what's at stake with the 2005 rewrite of the Illinois Telecommunications Act.
There's several dimensions of relevance, and we're trying to bring together diverse coalitions. And the great thing is we've got a series of points that we want in our coalition that we've all signed upon as like principles. Mm-hmm. And these diverse groups have signed on, and they were ready to agree to the principles without any real debate, that they recognize each part of this, like, the digital divide needs to be addressed, and the digital divide is real. It mm-hmm. still exists, mm-hmm. And we need funding to achieve digital literacy across different sectors of the population, not just, let's say, the most disadvantaged in society, mm-hmm. but also other groups like the elderly. And this is important as a cost-saving tool for government as well, and it could be sold that way, that if you have more people digitally literate and online, they need the literacy, they need the computers, they need the access. Mm-hmm. If you get them online, they can do things more cost effectively, they can do their taxes. Some communities, you know, the state government is not going to send out the not for any community, anywhere, they're not going to be mailing you your tax returns, because they said you can get it online or you can go pick it up somewhere. Mm-hmm. Well, the people that are not online, they got to go out of their way and pick it up somewhere. Mm-hmm. Right, the other people have the advantage, they just get it. Same thing with vehicle register, like certain things with DMV, mm-hmm. you can do online, but only in certain communities. Mm-hmm. Right? That's not fair, essentially. That's just one dimension. There's other aspects which are sort of consumer protections. Mm-hmm. And this is certainly not only about internet. This is about internet. This is about your telephone bill. This is about your cell phone bill. This is about, it should also be about your cable bill. I don't know if they're going to get you that and how your cable service runs. These are about your bills and also the service quality mm-hmm. of things and how consumers are protected. And one interesting thing which everyone knows is how you deal with these giant communications corporations is you get contracts, and if you have to break your contract early, you get a penalty. Now, if you buy a plan for your communication services and you decide you're going to get a combined plan of your phone, your internet, your wireless, your long distance, and they just sell it to you as a package, you break any one of them and they give you, let's say, $150 penalty. Well, didn't I agree to one contract? Mm-hmm. Where's your real protection? There are things like the Illinois Commerce Commission, which is supposed to be a regulatory body on this, and the telcos are pushing for deregulation, mm-hmm. essentially, and they can give a rationale that the cable corporations are effectively not regulated by the state. It's a federal local issue, mm-hmm. really, because mm-hmm. they have a franchise, and they're with the convergence of media, and what can happen on any of these different infrastructure, technology platforms, or communications that you can deliver all these services, mm-hmm. certainly a cable company has a certain kind of advantage by not being regulated by the state over, let's say, the ILECs, which are the incumbent local exchange carriers, which really means SBC mm-hmm. in Illinois. There's another party, which are the CLECs, competitive local exchange carriers, which they've basically been almost knocked off the plate, and they want to get back on the plate and there should be true competition in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. We're at a stage where how many choices for phone carriers does any citizen really have? I think it's small, but they point to the lowering of costs as having been achieved over these past several years since the last rewrite. Mm-hmm. Well, that may be true, but I think it's only partially true, because the total cost for telecommunications in your home is probably higher, even though your phone bill or, let's say, your internet bill may have gone down. A lot of families, if they're really being connected, they're connecting on several different channels: your phone, your telephone, your wireless, possibly your internet, possibly your cable too. All these, if as a total package, your costs have gone up monthly, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And certainly cable bills have gone up. Now, is it, you know, they're saying things have costs have gone down, but if people don't get the adequate picture and context, they don't really know what happened, and they need to know. And they also need certain protections. As cell phones, for example, and other combined packages that are sold to you, there's really unfair practices in their marketing, the mm-hmm. deceptive practices, and the elderly especially need protections on this. Tons of groups where it's really despicable, in my view, how it's handled. And I think it's just a matter of, it's almost incidental how these different things are categorized in terms of the history of the law. That's why cell phones are currently unregulated mm-hmm. in a certain respect, or less regulated than the other phone service. But in the move towards deregulation, you've got the idea that, you know, the phone company wants to avoid having to provide the universal service coverage to all the population. Right now, they're sort of required to cover 80% of the population in any area. They want to wipe that out, if mm-hmm. possible, mm-hmm. right? Universal service is a principle that was established in the 1930s, actually. I don't have all the history on mm-hmm. this, but I just know the approximate timing of it. And there's a community good to this that we should not let go of. And we should understand I've given a certain categories of things, like there's the digital literacy aspect of this, and there's consumer protections, and there's emergency services and other just basic services that you need the network out there and deployed for and reaching everybody. Otherwise, there's a lot greater cost in giving them like basic protections of society and services, and makes them actually connected to the real society mm-hmm. and world. And you have to treat these things as essentials now. Before, we only treated the telephone as essential. So when the Citizens Utility Board was formed mm-hmm. around 1983, I think, and there was a movement to bring sort of regulation and protections into place, and it's really a watchdog group. It's not there to enforce anything. It's to sort of watch and certain things. But with, as I mentioned, this convergence, the emergence of new technologies and their convergence of the transport media and other things, we need an entity that is going to provide that same kind of watchdog service on several different levels, at all different levels of transport, effectively, and service providing and contracts that people get. AARP is active in this, that the elderly need protections, and you figure the elderly need to get online to get the various services, for, like health services that are going online and other social security benefits, other things that you need to go online to just find things out and know how to interact, basically.
To learn more about the issue, and to learn more about how to get more involved, you can visit the website and join the emailing list of the Get Illinois Online Coalition at getillinoisonline.org. Chicago Indie Media's own website at chicago.indiemedia.org will also be providing coverage of the latest happenings and breaking developments in the struggle over the political future of digital technologies in Illinois.